Ghost Knight Media Studios and Paranormal Underground Magazine, welcome to Paranormal Underground Radio. It's time to explore the unexplained with your hosts, Rick Hale and Karen Frazier.
And it is Thursday night, and if you can hear our voices, you are exactly where you need to be. She is Karen Frazier. I am Rick Hale. This is Paranormal Underground Radio at ztalkradio.com. And hopefully nobody just heard the F-bomb, the super terrific F-bomb that Karen just dropped on all of us. So hopefully nobody...
No, I was getting it out of my system before we went on the air.
That was the most hysterical thing I've ever heard. You got like all like it was like Southside Chicago on me there for a second.
I was being all rock and roll, man.
Good evening, Karen. How are you?
Apparently fine.
Now that you got that F-bomb out.
I feel so much better.
Good. Yeah, it's like taking a big old poop getting that F-bomb out right before the show starts.
Well, this is a family show, so now, you know, I can just be nice and calm.
Yes, this is definitely a family show, and we don't, you know, want to, you know, drop any F-bombs or show anything that's naughty. But, however, tonight we do have a great guest on our show. We are going to be joined by, joined by Duncan Lunan, who is the author of Children from the Sky, which is a speculative investigation into one of actually my favorite legends concerning medieval Europe is the Green Children of Woolpit. And apparently he's got some huge, he's been doing a lot of historical research. And I guess that the descendants of the Green Girl of Woolpit still walk among us today. So,
you think it's me.
I think it's you, either that or like talking about the immortals and they're, you know, lopping each other's heads off and there could be only one.
Oh, I thought it's maybe a possibility. I thought it was me because you saw the picture of myself I posted on Facebook today of me and the bunny ears.
Oh, that was definitely a dead giveaway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that shows you just how special I really am, right?
Yes, you are very special.
Yes, I'm special. So that'll be a fun conversation. I know absolutely nothing about the subject, but I know you know lots about it. Yep. So, you know, I may pipe in every once in a while because I'm not good at staying quiet.
She never shuts up.
It's true. It's absolutely truth, let me tell you. And, you know, my son, it just drives him nuts because I'm really cheerful in the morning, early in the morning, first thing I wake up. Because I used to teach a 6 a.m. aerobics class. Okay. And when you teach a 6 o'clock in the morning aerobics class, and I would open the gym at 5:30, you have to be perky or nobody's going to do the aerobics you're teaching.
You know what? I can honestly see that. I mean, nobody wants to come in there and you're smoking a cigarette and drinking your coffee. It's like, shut up, leave me alone.
All right, leg lifts, everybody.
And one and two.
Maybe I should have tried that. I don't know. But so the bottom line is I'm a morning person. I'm not a nice night person. And I'm very, very perky. And I live with a bunch of not morning people. And I drive them nuts because I pop out of bed and bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and chatterboxy, and they all want to kill me.
No. See, in my house, nobody isn't. But then again, we also, you know, sleep very different schedules because of the hours that I work. But none of us are morning people. I mean, even Theo gives you that look like, I will effing kill you if you don't leave me alone.
Yeah, Tanner's always been that way, too. He is not a morning boy. And like I say, I'm at my best first thing in the morning. And that rubs a few people the wrong way, I've discovered. But I can't help it. It's who I am.
No, and you know what? And that's part of your personality. I mean, when I used to be, you know, like a smoker and stuff, I was like, don't bother me until I've had my first cigarette. Don't bother me until I have poured some coffee down my gullet. Don't even bother with me. But now it's like, I don't smoke anymore. I have a 2-year-old. When I first get up and in the evening, you know, 5:30 at night, he wants to play. So it's like I've had to kind of switch over from being a morning person to somewhere in between.
Yeah. Well, mine was necessity too. Like I say, perky at 5:30 in the morning for all those gym rats. So, hey, I hear you got a package in the mail today.
I did.
Was it ticking?
You know what? I'm surprised that you have not sent me a ticking package yet.
Well, that you know of.
Christmas is coming soon.
That's right.
And my birthday is about 3 weeks away. So, a little less than a month. Tick, tick, tick. Yeah, I got your new book today, and I can't wait to read it. I really liked Avalanche. I thought that was a great book. Jamie really liked it, which is kind of weird because she doesn't really, dig this kind of thing. But, we're definitely, looking forward to it.
But I'm such a fabulous writer.
Karen, if it wasn't for you, I would not even be here.
Oh, really?
How many times have I had to tell you that until you believe it? Yes. I never would have contacted Paranormal Underground to do any writing. I would not be doing this show if it wasn't for the fact that I read one of your articles. I'm sorry, I don't remember which one it was. And I'm like, wow, this woman really gets it.
Cheryl's probably mad at me now that she knows that.
Oh, yeah, no. I thought I've made it very clear in the past, but yes, well, you Cheryl, are the reason.
I'll get you back later for that, Karen.
Great. I'm going to get a ticking package in the mail now.
That's okay. We'll all die. It'll be fun.
So, yes, I sent you a copy of my book, and I believe that if you read the acknowledgments, you'll notice your name in them. The new book is Dancing with the Afterlife.
Oh, wow. No, I hadn't seen that yet, but I can't wait to see. Is it going to be like, damn you, Rick Hale?
It absolutely is. The first thing it says is I start the very first word, because the acknowledgments are the first part of the book, and the very first word is an F-bomb followed by Rick Hale.
Oh, that's so fantastic. I can't wait to see that. No, I hadn't saw that yet.
Did I sign the book? F you, Rick?
No. No, you did not.
Oh, my God. What was I thinking?
Kill him with fire.
So, I understand that you're getting closer to a little something yourself.
We can't talk about that on air. You know that. Oh. I'm joking. No. Yeah. Yes. The geeks.
No, not her. That's not what I meant. Not that lady. Oh, sorry.
No. No. Yeah. The Geek's Guide to the Paranormal, Poltergeist, Ghosts, and Demons. I put in quotes. But yeah. It's finally my contribution to the paranormal community is coming to fruition.
That's exciting.
It is exciting. I mean, it's been my dream, and it's like. Everything that I do, the show, the magazine articles, the writing, anything that other projects I may do in the future is a legacy for my son. And it's very important to me.
Yes. Mm-hmm. By the time he's Tanner's age, you just don't care anymore. But good for you for thinking that now. No, I'm kidding.
No, and you're probably right.
Tanner has been the driving force behind everything I've done for the last 16 years. So I get it. I get what you're saying. Absolutely. So good. I'm excited. I'm excited to hear when that comes out. You'll keep us updated about that, of course.
Of course.
Yes, yes. So, hey, big
events.
How could
you not know about it? You work here, too.
I was just setting it up on the radio to give you the opportunity to tell. I was playing dumb.
Oh, no. Don't do that, Karen. You're
so, big, exciting stuff coming up here.
Yes.
Not next weekend, but the following weekend, which is Friday, March 8th, Saturday, March 9th, and Sunday, March 10th, I'm going to be at the Oregon Ghost Conference. A lot of Paranormal Underground writers and contributors are actually going to be at this conference. I'll be there. Rob St. Helen, who writes the Tales from the Haunted Heathman, will be there. William Becker will be there, and he writes a column for the magazine. The gal that writes Silver, Cheryl, I'm going to say her real name, and I know she uses a pen name, and so I'm not coming up with it. Silver Moon Medicine, is that?
That's it. You got it.
Okay, she'll be there as well, and then members of my team, and a lot of really fun people are going to be at this conference, and it's in Oregon City. I know, it's going to be so much fun. It's in Oregon City, and It's Friday afternoon through Sunday afternoon, and I'll be signing books, and I'll be speaking on Saturdays. So if you happen to be in the area, come on by, because you'll meet a lot of really cool. Oh, Dave Galvin. Dave Galvin's going to be there. He's speaking Friday night.
No, I really want to be there.
Yeah. Well, but he's, you know, he contributes to Paranormal Underground too. So what I'm saying is that a lot of the people who contribute to the magazine are going to be there. And if, you know, you're a fan of the magazine, fan of the radio show, come on by, because you'll get to meet a lot of the people who do the writing, just not Rick Hale or Cheryl or Chad.
No, sorry.
Because they all suck.
That's right. But you do get Karen, who is the real star of Paranormal Underground.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I am. I'm just amazing, aren't I? Woo.
Woohoo.
Yeah. Anyway, so we need to take a break.
Yes.
When we come back, we are going to be talking to our guest, Duncan Lunan, about the Woolpit Green something.
The Green Children of Woolpit.
Green Children of Woolpit. I am really looking forward to it because I know nothing about it. So stick around. It's Z Talk Radio or Paranormal Underground Radio on Z Talk Radio. We will be right back.
Do you want to keep up with what's going on at Paranormal Underground?
Then tweet us on Twitter at Paranormal UG.
Or follow us on Facebook at Paranormal Underground.
Meet us on MySpace, Paranormal Underground.
There's no need to be in the dark about what's going on at Paranormal Underground. Join us on your favorite social networking site today. Hi, I'm Chad Wilson, publisher and co-founder of Paranormal Underground Magazine.
And I'm Cheryl Knight, editor-in-chief and co-founder of Paranormal Underground Magazine.
Every month, Paranormal Underground explores the unexplained with a free monthly online magazine.
We take an in-depth look at all kinds of unexplained phenomena, talk with some of the field's top experts, and share the latest news and information about the paranormal.
Visit us at ParanormalUnderground.net, where you can read the magazine online, explore our paranormal evidence galleries, watch videos, participate in discussions, or read blogs with some of our writers and editors.
We hope you'll join us. Visit ParanormalUnderground.net and explore the unexplained.
Hi, this is Karen Frazier, author of Avalanche of Spirits, The Ghosts of Wellington, a new book from Ghost Night Media. In summer of 2009, I visited Wellington, Washington, a former railroad town in the Cascade Mountains of Washington State, where the worst avalanche disaster in the history of the United States occurred. 96 people lost their lives. What I found there changed my life forever. Before I visited Wellington, I wasn't sure that I believed in ghosts or even in the human soul. Now I know for sure that ghosts are real and that our souls go on after we die. You can read all about my experiences at Wellington in my new book, Avalanche of Spirits, The Ghosts of Wellington, which is on sale at Amazon.com. To learn more, visit avalancheofspirits.com.
First there came radio, and it was good. Then it got bad. Then there came satellite radio, and it was okay. Then it got too expensive and kind of sucked. Now there is something new, something better, something free. Stitcher Radio for the iPhone and BlackBerry. With Stitcher, you can hear all the shows and podcasts you can imagine, rate them, and build your own station. No downloading, no syncing, no problem. Just pick a station to get started, like American news and politics. Now, look at the shows you have to pick from, pick one, and start listening. Like it, make a favorite, and start your own station. Don't like it? Thumb it down and say bye-bye to shows like it. Or thumb it up to find more like it. Plus, you can search and find your favorite podcasts. We have over 1,000 shows to pick from. Stitcher Radio, the natural evolution in audio listening. And it's free.
On the go and missing another one of your favorite Z-Talk shows? Now you don't have to. Simply go to the Google Play Store on your Android phone and download the Z-Talk Radio app. The best part is, it's absolutely free. That's Z-Talk Radio, only found in your Google Play Store on your Android phone. Download it today.
station identification.
You're listening to ZTalk Radio Network.
Operating frequency
on ztalkradio.com. The views expressed and opinions given by the individual hosts and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of ZTalk Radio, its affiliates, or sponsors.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Paranormal Underground Radio at ztalkradio.com. We are your hosts, Karen and Rick. Tonight joining us is going to be Duncan Lunan, who is author of Children from the Sky, a speculative investigation into one of the Middle Ages' more enduring enigmas, the Green Children of Woolpit. Also, he is an incredibly prolific writer, and we're going to get into all that tonight. So, Duncan, thank you for joining us on the Underground.
My pleasure.
Great.
Nice to be here.
Very good, then. So we were talking a little bit before we went on air, and I was telling you, and I've also, you know, told my colleagues as well as the listeners that the Green Children of Woolpit, the subject of your book, Children from the Sky, is definitely by far one of my favorite legends concerning medieval Europe as a whole. And it's so well documented. That's the thing that I love about it. Can you, you know, for those of our listeners who don't understand what the Green Children of Woolpit is, can you give us just let us know what it was all about and what makes it so interesting?
Okay. Well, I came across it when I was a student in the astronomy section of the Anatomy of Melancholy by Robert Burton, which was written in 1621, where he's talking about the excitement that he feels about the plurality of worlds and the idea that Mars and Venus could be inhabited. And then you get this wonderful throwaway line that those green children which fell from heaven that Nubergensis writes of in his time may have come from thence. Nubergensis turns out to be William of Newburgh, who's regarded as a reliable source for the 12th century. Furthermore, the story is also told by Ralph of Coggeshall, who's another reliable historian, and they tell it from totally different viewpoints, which is encouraging. Mm-hmm. But the essence of it is that at a date in the second half of the 12th century, and the date is one of the few things they disagree on, two very strange children came out of an ancient earthwork near the village of Woolpit in East Anglia. It's about 8 miles east of Bury St. Edmunds. And the children were dressed in clothing of a colour and material never seen before and spoke language that nobody recognised, both of which are odd because Woolpit was an aspiring market town on what was then the major pilgrim route in England.
Okay.
But the major thing that attracted everyone's attention was that the children were coloured green all over.
Now, Duncan, when you say that they're coloured green, are we talking like a very dark shade, almost pea pod-ish type green?
Yeah, they're described as leek green. Yeah, it's a really bright, strong shade of green. Initially, they seem to have been quite roughly treated because it was found out very quickly that they were green all over. And they were put on exhibition. And after some unspecified interval, it occurred to people that they might need something to eat. And they wouldn't eat, at which point alarm bells started ringing. And common sense eventually kicked in. They were taken to the home of a knight called Richard de Calne. Mm-hmm. When you start to trace his background, which is very difficult, suddenly the whole story takes on a completely different perspective because he was a very important man. Mm-hmm. And the villagers crossed the land. They didn't go towards Bury St. Edmunds where you would expect them to go. They went almost at right angles to that and more than 20 miles crossing the land of two other barons to get to De Calne. So at that point, obviously, they knew where they were going and what they were doing. Mm-hmm. So De Calne took the children in. They nearly starved to death before they were eventually because they refused everything they were offered until they saw bean plants and recognized the color. And the curious thing was that they didn't recognize the plant. They didn't know which bit was edible and had to be shown that.
Okay.
But for a long time, they would still eat nothing else but eventually they were tempted onto bread and other food. They lost the green color, and of course people thought the two things were connected. But when they had learned our manner of speaking, it seemed to the wise that they might be christened, and even that was done. That's a direct quote. Okay. And at that point, the language in both Chronicles goes formal. And what people have been translating in modern times as "she said" and "they said" is actually "gave on evidence" or "swore on oath."
Okay.
And I thought, I need to know more here. So I phoned a friend of mine who has a diploma in theology from the Roman Catholic College of Cardinals. And he said, "Oh, everybody knows that." So I said, "Well, I'm sorry, but I don't." He said, "Well, even today, a christening in controversial circumstances must be preceded by an inquisitio, which, with a small I, which is a formal hearing conducted by a bishop." And of course, anybody reading the chronicle account, probably in a monastery themselves, would know that, and right, would get the point that where this language is describing a formal proceedings and people giving evidence, you're talking about something that really happened. And this is where I think the story becomes fascinating. Even before I knew all this background, this was the bit that grabbed me.
Sure.
Is that they're asked by the bishop, who are you and where are you from? And they reply, "We are people of the land of St. Martin." Now, I found out where the land of St. Martin is and what this is about, but we can come back to that, because it's the bit that's really important. The bishop says, "Oh, that sounds..." Basically, he says, "That sounds all right. Do they believe in our Saviour there?" And since it's named after a Christian saint, supposedly, the children said yes, and the place is full of churches. And the last question was, "And does the sun rise or set there?" And all they had to say at that point was yes, because the medieval belief was that there was no sun in fairyland.
Okay.
Couldn't bring themselves to lie at that point, and they said no, putting themselves into a great deal of danger. And
now, why is that? For example, I'm sure that by now fairy land and the fairies, or the gentry, as my grandmother always insisted I call them, they were pretty much demonized at this point, correct?
Well, the key point was, did they have souls? Could they be christened? This is the purpose of the hearing, is to determine whether they are fit to be christened.
Mm-hmm.
And they've obviously been given a cover story to tell, which is going to make everything all right, and they don't stick to it. If the bishop rules that they can't be christened, then clearly they're not human, and anything could happen, and probably the worst would happen. But what they described at that point was life in a land of permanent twilight, separated by a broad river from a land of permanent sunlight. And it sounds like the twilight zone of a planet with a trapped rotation, keeping the same face always towards the sun.
Right.
This was why Burton put it in the astronomy section of his book, because he knew you couldn't find those conditions on Earth. And that was what intrigued me right from the outset when I first checked out the Green Children story. And we're going back to the mid-60s at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't until 1993 that I finally decided to do something about it. I was covering a conference for the Glasgow Herald, which was being held by the British National Space Centre in London. And at the end of it, I took the bus up to East Anglia, and I went to the village of Woolpit. And beforehand, I'd got together with a historian friend of mine and worked out a list of questions. And I was made very welcome. The National Geographic Ancient X-Files reconstruction of this is not a bit like what really happened. I was shown all around. They opened up the local history museum for me. But when I was asking my questions, people kept saying, "Well, you'd have to go to the county records office for that kind of thing." So I went into Bury St. Edmunds, joined the County Archives Research Network, and at that point they said, "Well, there's the card index, let us know what you want to see." And 5 hours later, I had become convinced that I was onto something big because I was finding answers.
Now, when you say you're onto something big, okay, first off, one of the interesting things that I always found about the legend is, of course, what the skeptics have to say concerning the Green Children. A lot of them say, you know, something to the effect that, oh, they may have been from China and they mistook the green for yellow for whatever reason. I don't know. That they may have been Norse, or they may have actually found their way from across from North America. Except from North America, though, the British at that time would have been very familiar with people from different cultures and different countries. Am I correct in assuming that?
Particularly where they were. Although Thomas à Becket was dead by this time, his shrine at Canterbury was yet to become the major pilgrimage centre as it did become. And at that time, the shrine of St. Edmund in Bury St. Edmunds was the major place of pilgrimage in the British Isles. And Woolpit lay on the Pilgrim Road from the coast at Ipswich to Bury St. Edmunds itself, and was still a good 8 miles away from it. So you would imagine, especially, as I say, the place had aspirations to be a market town, and it became one later.
Sure.
You would think the villagers would have been able to say, would you like a bed for the night and a meal and a pint of ale, and in just about every language in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be something special to attract this much attention. It's when you start to focus on Richard de Calne that you realise just how special. Because he's very hard to trace. And a lot of modern writers have just made assumptions that he was the lord of the manor in Woolpit, which didn't actually have one. And, you know, that he, because there's no record of him, he might be a masterless knight, basically a horse and a sword for hire.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, he's much bigger than that. To begin with, he's a lot older than most people think. He was born no later than 1116. This event, I believe, I pinned down to 1173, so he was a good age at this point. But he, at the end of the Civil War between Stephen and Matilda, when financial records started up again, almost the very first entry in the opening paragraph is that Sir Richard, Lord Richard de Calne is excused all taxes in perpetuity because of his outstanding service to the new King Henry. And we don't know what that service was, but it's got to be something very big for him to be excused all taxes, to be excused some taxes, which is quite routine. And in fact, even before the Civil War, de Calne had been excused one or two. But to be excused all of them makes him invisible. He's the head of the Secret Service. He's M. There is no record of him for the rest of his life, except when occasionally he witnesses a gift of a member of his family to the church. He's just there and not there, as it were. But it turns out from the records that we have before he disappears from the records, at that point he had at least 15 knights in service to him in East Anglia alone, and he still had family property back in Wiltshire, where he came from.
So he was a big deal.
He was a vavasour. He was intermediate in status between a knight and a baron.
Okay.
He wasn't actually ennobled, but he was a big man.
Okay.
And his family, when you trace them, which took me a long time before the penny dropped. When people are talking about the bishops, they usually give you the Christian name and the see. So you have Nigel of Ely and Everard of Norwich and so on.
Okay.
It turns out they're all de Calne's. Nigel of Ely was Richard de Calne's father. Everard of Norwich was his uncle. Richard of London was his half brother. Alexander of Lincoln was his cousin.
Okay.
His great uncle was not just the Bishop of Salisbury, but treasurer and Chancellor and even Regent of England under Henry I. The de Calneys were an extremely powerful family. In fact, it's slightly odd that as a younger son of the family, Richard de Calne becomes a knight. That's not usual for the younger son in a family of churchmen.
Right.
So he must have done something special.
So, Duncan, I actually have a question from somebody from Elaine in our chat room. And she says that I read an article once stating that the Woolpit children had chlorosis. What evidence is there to support that it was something different?
Well, chlorosis these days turns up in medical dictionaries under the heading diseases that never were. Chlorosis was supposedly a nervous condition associated with iron deficiency, which appeared in the with the Industrial Revolution. It was an urban complaint. And nobody actually had a patient who turned green. They had, everybody knew somebody who had a patient who turned green. But
So it was like an urban legend.
It is. It's a catch-all for a whole range of nervous conditions, which would include what we now call anorexia nervosa. It was a disease of young women in early industrial society, not something that you would turn up hundreds of years earlier in rural conditions. It just doesn't fit. There never was such an actual disease.
Okay, and they probably didn't have self-tanner back then, so that didn't turn them green. That was a joke.
Yeah, I didn't get it. They didn't have what?
self-tanner. You know how people put like that tanning lotion on and it turns them green?
It was not New Jersey.
However, I think you've hit the nail right on the head. Because after going through a consultation with doctors and all kinds of people, I couldn't find anything that actually turns people green. I did meet a homeopathic doctor who had a patient who once turned green, but that was due to acute retention of bile products. It's a sign of imminent death.
And
the children were clearly not in that condition.
Sure.
But trust the text. In Ralph of Coggeshall's account, she's asked, why were you green when you came here? And she replied, all the people in the land that I came from are dyed with the same colour as the plants. And, yeah, it's a vegetable dye. That's what it is. And the implication from what I think I'm reading in the subtext is that it was some kind of camouflage, some kind of protective coloration. But it wore off.
Okay.
Oh, so they didn't stay green?
No. By the time they had learned our manner of speaking, they're described as having become completely like children of our own race. Yeah, they were no longer green. There was nothing strange about them anymore. Oh. They seemed perfect once they lost the color.
A rather unattractive, pasty white like the rest of us, I suppose.
Probably not in those days. But I would be very interested if they kept, given that they said that they came from a country of permanent twilight and they'd never seen the sun before. I would be interested to know, did they get sunburned? How did they manage?
That's true.
Sure.
Well, so where would that be, a place of permanent twilight? Clearly not on this planet.
Definitely not. The possibility that you could have a planet keeping the same face always towards the sun with habitable conditions in the twilight zone goes back to old ideas about the planet Mercury when we used to think it was like that. But that's the origin of the expression, which Rod Serling afterwards made famous in a different way. But at the time I was writing the book, it was still thought that such a planet wouldn't naturally be habitable. And in the speculative final section of the book, I got together with a bunch of friends, and we did what science fiction writers call world-building, where we imagined a world which had already was in that condition, but the twilight zone had artificially been made habitable. However, there have been more recent studies conducted, particularly at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, on what conditions you might get with an Earth-like planet orbiting a star smaller than the Sun, so that the habitable zone was close enough that tidal forces would lock the rotation of the planet to the period of the orbit. And they've come to the conclusion that it would probably develop what they call super rotation, which we see in the atmosphere of Venus, where the atmosphere rotates more rapidly than the planet itself. And that would give you habitable conditions on a planet like that. So maybe it wouldn't be even quite as esoteric as what I've described in the book. But, whatever it is, as you say, it's not this Earth. It's a planet like Earth. One of the noticeable things was that the children, when they found themselves in the pit, eventually made a run for it across the field. So the gravity can't have been all that different if they had come from a different planet.
Sure.
There's quite a lot you can deduce from the clues in the story about conditions on the planet. I had a lot of fun with that. There's a couple of chapters in the book devoted to it.
So what we're talking about here is we have literal little green men that we're dealing with here. So but, extraterrestrials.
No, unquestionably human.
Okay.
The boy died, but the girl grew up and married.
Okay.
And I believe that I traced her in the historical record, and if she's who I believe her to be, she married Richard Barr, who was one of the king's senior ambassadors, which again tells you that she's something special.
Mm-hmm.
And she had two children. And I've traced her descendants down to the present. In fact, I've traced two lines of her descendants.
Now, I find that incredibly fascinating. I mean, in my own family, I know that my family came to the United States in 1645. Before then, I can find nothing concerning my family. I know they're from Northern Ireland, and that's about it. But I mean, the idea of tracing somebody all the way back to the 12th century is mind-boggling. How did you accomplish something like that?
Well, fortunately, the work has been done for me. Starting under George III, of all people, the British monarchy for a considerable time interested itself in the preserving of the records of the medieval period, and eventually, under Queen Victoria, the task was hived off to various voluntary bodies, all dedicating their work to Victoria herself, of course. And one of these bodies, particularly, concerned itself with medieval history of Staffordshire and produced, goodness knows, an entire bookcase of published records from the medieval period and later.
Okay.
And cross-checking that with property records and court records and the rest of it, I just systematically worked on from through the lifetime of the Green Girl and on down to 1340. That was as far as I got.
Okay.
And at that point, I finally wrote my article, and it was published in the magazine Analogue. And I got a letter from a reader who said, I have been tracing my family, and the reason I started doing it is that I'm related to George Washington. And although it's not in the same line of my descent, I can trace my family back to a lady named Anne Barr in 1340. Is it the same Anne Barr where your story stops? And he gave me his references, and I checked them out, and everything dovetailed. It was perfect. He had, in fact, done the other half of the research from working back from the present day to 1340, and he turned out to be descended from the Green Girl, from Agnes Barr. But the thing about it was that he was connected to a very powerful family called the Shirleys, who had intermarried with the Devereux family, one of whom had married Anne Barr, and this is where this all came together. So the published history of the Shirley family is quite easy to locate, and in fact, the they are the holders of the title. They're the Earls Ferrers. And the current Earl Ferrers was, among other things, deputy leader of the House of Lords under Margaret Thatcher. And he thought this was absolutely wonderful. I wasn't sure how to approach him, but the story came out when I spoke to the Fortean Society on convention in London. And he was outed by the Evening Times in Glasgow with the headline, "Tory Lord Descended from Green Woman from Outer Space." And
that's not something you want to read.
He said, "It sounds bizarre. I knew my ancestors were colourful, but not that colourful."
Oh, excellent.
I'm very glad that you've taken this in such good part, because I wasn't sure how to approach you with it. And he wrote back, "But I can supply 200 years of your family background that's not in your published history." And he said, "Well, never mind about them. Tell me about the Green Woman from Outer Space." Yeah, he thought it was great.
Oh, that's funny. So you mentioned earlier the village that they said that they were from, and you said it was St. Martin, Forum St. Martin, something like that. Now, isn't that part of one of the potential historical explanations that they have for where these kids came from?
Doesn't fit. In fact, that's not what it is at all. Coggeshall Abbey, where Ralph of Coggeshall obviously wrote his account, was a Cistercian abbey under the control of the Bishop of London. And when I was researching the history of that and the surrounding area, I actually came upon the land of St. Martin. And, you know, the best way to conceal something is to hide it in plain sight.
Sure.
Terra Sancti Martini in block capitals in the Domesday Book is the Essex property of the Church of St. Martin le Grand in London, which stood next door to St. Paul's, was controlled jointly with St. Paul's by the Bishop of London, who also controlled Coggeshall Abbey. And this was the Essex property of that church, which was the principal sanctuary in England, the only place which could confer permanent sanctuary. So it's very clever, this. And again, anyone of the time reading it would probably have got it. Asked who and from whence they were, they're said to have replied, "We are people of the land of St. Martin." It's not "where are you from," it's "who are you?" "We are people who are already under your protection." And so, yeah, that is the significance of the St. Martin reference. It ties the Bishop of London straight into the story.
And interesting.
He was very much King Henry's man, as was de Calne. And it all just clicks together, and it goes on clicking together like that.
So technically, really, there really is, besides the odd color and the strange language, there really isn't anything that is supernatural or paranormal or anything concerning these children.
Well, if you can accept that they came from another world, apparently by teleportation, and they themselves said that it was an accident of that kind.
Sure.
But yeah, it's perhaps high technology rather than the paranormal in that sense. Yes, I would agree.
Okay.
But the idea that there is a human settlement, or was, that someone had established on another planet, apparently for some kind of research purposes, with the knowledge, if not the connivance, of some of the terrestrial authorities, that's the plot of the X-Files.
Right.
I mean, we haven't touched yet at all on the King's involvement, let alone the Pope's.
Actually, I was going to ask that, but I think what we're going to do is first we're going to take a break. Does that sound good with you, Karen? Karen?
Hello?
Oh, I muted myself. Oh. I'm so sorry. I'm sitting here talking. Yes, let's take a break. When we come back, we can start talking about the King's involvement in all of it. And so stick around. We're talking to Duncan Lunan. This is Paranormal Underground Radio on Z Talk Radio. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Joe.
And Steven Tyler from Aerosmith. Here for RAD. Recording artists, actors, and athletes against drunk driving. Yeah, you know we love it when the music does the talking.
And you know, the music stops when someone gets killed.
So never, 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 never
let someone you know get behind the wheel if they've been drinking. So keep it real, keep it real. Friends don't let friends drive drunk.
A public service message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
Your assignment is to listen to The Buzz on Monday nights from 8 to 10 p.m. Central on ztalkradio.com. This message will self-destruct.
Hi, I'm Ryan Seacrest for RAD. Over 300 people in this country are killed every week by a drunk driver. That's the equivalent of 2 747 plane crashes every single week. And the problem isn't going away unless we all do our part to stop it. So if you see someone who's about to drive after drinking, get the keys. Don't leave it up to anyone else. Friends don't let friends drive drunk.
A public service announcement brought to you by RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
You're listening to ZTalk Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Paranormal Underground Radio on ztalkradio.com. We are your hosts, Karen and Rick. For the last 45 minutes or so, we have been speaking with Duncan Lunan, and a fascinating conversation concerning one of my favorite legends of old Europe, the Green Children of Woolpit. So thank you so much, Duncan, for sticking around for a little bit longer to talk about this.
Yeah, I'm having fun.
Great, fantastic. That's kind of like that's how we want to run things here. Okay, so when before we went on break, I really wanted to touch more on what king, country, and, you know, God's representative had to think about this. But let's start with the king. Who was the reigning king at that time?
Well, at that time, which I think I've narrowed down to 1173 when the children arrived, that was Henry II. He'd been on the throne then since 1155. And one of the quite remarkable things that he had done quite early in his reign was to take control of the village of Woolpit away from the Abbot of Bury St. Edmunds and give it to supposedly a poor clerk who needed the income. The village was worth £10 a year. But in fact, the chap he put in charge of Woolpit was the Vice-Chancellor of England, who was just about the richest man in the country. A man who was expected to entertain visiting royalty at his own expense, and in those days thought nothing of spending £10,000 on a banquet. He was not stuck for £10 a year from this tiny village. And the fact that he had been put in charge of it, again, would have won people off in the church when they realised who was involved in what was going on. They'd have said, the king's got business here, we'd better stay clear of it. The thing about the annexation of Woolpit, which is most peculiar, is a future abbot of Bury St. Edmunds called Samson de Bottington, who was a schoolteacher at the time in 1160, made it his business to go to Rome, supposedly, to get the Pope to order the king to return the village. And he came back and told everybody that he'd succeeded. But the letter, Pope's letter, survives, and it's addressed to the Abbot of Bury St. Edmunds. And what it says is, concerning the Church of St. Mary Woolpit, and by inference the village attached to it, I have ordered that it is to be returned to you when the king shall have finished with it. Which is a very significant remark, because the Pope is not going to order the king to give the village back, and he knows there's something important going on there. And the whole issue really comes to a head in 1173. Everything focuses on that date. That seems to be when the children appeared. Everything went up in the air as a result.
Now, I can't really imagine, you know, that you have these odd children that appear all of a sudden. They look weird, they sound weird, they dress weird, they act weird. How did the king actually think of this? Was he suspicious of them? Did he think that they come from the fairyland? Or from a land far away? What was the king's reaction concerning all of this?
You have to think, well, why would people of the caliber of de Calne and the king be interested at all? You know, lost children. I mean, it's a time of unrest. There's been a major civil war. There was an invasion coming. Following the murder of Becket, England was very close to rebellion. Sure. And in fact, the king's sons and his queen had rebelled against him in 1173. Why would he care about two lost children unless it was the tip of an iceberg? It related to something much bigger. What happened was, when war broke out in 1173, Henry II went to Normandy, and he was defending his border against the King of France. And in late July, round about the start of the harvest time, which fits with the story, he suddenly dashed back to England for 4 days. We don't know where he went, but we do know he was in the vicinity of East Anglia. He didn't go to London or Winchester or any of the seats of power, but his expenses were met by the Sheriff of Northampton, which tells you he was in the area.
Okay.
And what he did was to put a garrison of crack troops into the castle next to Woolpit and then dash back to the war. And it appears, in fact, that those crack troops were Knights Templar. And de Calne was an associate Templar, it seems.
Okay.
But and at the point when I discovered the Templars were involved, I I just about thought, oh no, not them again.
But, yeah, everybody with them, everybody thinks that they're, you know, they're still around and trying to take over the world, essentially.
Well, yeah, that'll be right. But the thing is, the Templars were so powerful then that if anything was going on, they'd have had somebody on the inside. And it certainly seems that in this case they did. But again, it's the fact that this tiny village, which is not in a was not then in a war zone, should be thought worthy of putting 300 crack troops in. Tells you again that there's something very big going on. The episode with the children is just something, an oddity, something that they were expecting to happen. The villagers probably had instructions that if anything really strange happened, they should go to the Kalna and there'd be a reward for it. The whole business of the annexation of the village, putting the vice chancellor in charge of it, putting the crack troops in, and all the rest of it, it all implies that something very big is going on.
So let me ask you this: did they perhaps see these children as a threat? You know, maybe advanced troops from some unknown enemy?
Perhaps. We can only guess at that part, but it might very well be that the idea that somebody was coming back from this unknown destination would seem highly sinister.
Sure.
Or perhaps it was simply to protect the site in case things were opening up and something even bigger was going to happen. We're not seeing the whole story. We're seeing enough of it to be really intriguing. We haven't even started yet on the weather, the weather in the sky, which was very strange at the time. Henry obviously thought this was sufficiently serious matter that he had to put some reliable people in, and rather a lot of them.
Right. I mean, 300 people, you know, especially crack troops and Knights Templars. I mean, let's face it, Knights Templars will kill you right where you stand with a stare. To put 300 of them in one spot, it does seem highly unusual.
It's absolutely extraordinary. What happened next was that the Earl of Leicester, who had unsuccessfully rebelled on his own territory, had crossed to Flanders, which was in the service of the King of France, and he'd raised an army, and he invaded East Anglia. And he conferred with the Earl of Norfolk and Suffolk, who was on the rebel side but not yet prepared to make his own move, was told about the garrison at Hagnet Castle next to Woolpit, and he detoured, besieged it. They weren't provisioned for a siege, and they surrendered almost immediately. But they surrendered as a unit of 300, called a Mora, which was indeed a Templar unit. Taking their cue from the Spartan army, in fact. And the entire 300 were taken for ransom, which is absolutely extraordinary.
Right.
Because in those days, what you did as a matter of routine was you just killed all the serving men and kept the nobles for ransom. It was so much cheaper and easier. But these guys surrendered en bloc and were made prisoners, all of them, all 300. So they've got to be special. And the clues, particularly the references to the Mora, say that they were almost certainly Templars.
Okay. So now you mentioned the weather. You gave us a little bit of a tease there that the weather was strange. So, I mean, so we're not just talking about there's like weird military action going on and there's weird kids showing up, but there's actual more weirdness that's going on surrounding this. So what was going on with the weather?
Well, it's the weather on the sun that we're concerned with.
Okay.
The sun was, in this period, at its most highly disturbed since the Bronze Age, since the time of Stonehenge, to be precise. And extraordinary things were happening. And here in Scotland in the present day, you've got to go up to the north to see colours in the aurora. Normally, I have seen red aurora this far south, but it's very unusual. At that time, they were getting red aurora all the way down into Syria. They were seeing huge displays of aurora borealis in the Holy Land. There are sightings in the Chronicles in the Far East, naked eye sightings of sunspots still on the 11-year cycle, but these are sunspots big enough to be visible to the naked eye.
Wow.
And through cloud or at sunset, whatever. And the Earth's magnetic field was extremely disturbed, and 1173 was the year when it was at its highest. In fact, it spikes that year. In February, for instance, there was a huge auroral display all over the British Isles, in which something happened over Ireland that sounds very much like a high-altitude nuclear explosion. And the fireball crossed the Irish Sea and was brighter than the midsummer sun when it came up over the horizon at Canterbury. A lot of very odd stuff was going on. Now, this brings us to the question, how did the children get here?
Right, and that's exactly what I was getting to. But first off, I want to know, how do you know here in the 21st century what sunspot activity was like in the 12th century?
Well, fortunately, it's been done for me. Back in the 70s or early 80s, there was some very major work done on particularly correlations with tree rings and other indications of solar disturbances by a chap called John Eddy, who published articles in Sky and Telescope and also in Scientific American, both of which I read at the time. And he goes into this in a great deal of detail. He's checked it with the medieval records and all of this kind of thing. And when you go to the medieval chronicles, it's all there. Most point we haven't touched on is that nearly all of this stuff is still in Latin. Very little of it is available in English. I've dedicated the book to the principal teacher of Latin at my old school. I could never have done it without him. But it's all there, and you have to do your own translations because, and where there are modern translations, people tend to be making assumptions. I mentioned the thing about translating "she swore on oath" as just "she said," because people aren't looking for a formal context to that particular passage. You do have to go to the chronicles and do literal translations and then look really hard at what the intended meaning was. But yes, it all ties together when you've got a period when the sun and the Earth's magnetic field were extremely disturbed. And the girl, when she was asked as a child about how she had come to Woolpit, she makes an extraordinary remark. She said, they were out with their father's livestock. This happened to them because they were out with their father's livestock. And it's a very strong causative construction in Latin. They were out on a certain day with their father's livestock, and this would not have happened to them but for that. They shouldn't have been out there. They suddenly heard a great sound like the bells of Bury St. Edmunds. And a lot of people just blur this and say they heard the bells of Bury St. Edmunds. But no, she said it was like the bells of Bury St. Edmunds. And then suddenly, as if placed in some absence of mind, we found ourselves in the field where you were reaping. This kid not only knows what amnesia is, but she knows she hasn't got it. And I think knocks the primitive runaway from a tribe in the woods theory completely on the head, that alone. Right. But what she describes at this point is instantaneous transmission. Suddenly, as if placed in some absence of mind, whammo, they were there, then they're here. Yeah. So I went to a physicist friend, well, a physics student. I knew that there wasn't a lot of point in going to anyone on professor level with something as wild as this. So I went to a physics student friend of mine and I said, if you've got a planet with a trapped rotation, it's turning very slowly on its axis. It probably has no magnetic field. It'd be like Venus in that respect. And at this end, the Earth's magnetic field is very disturbed. Can you visualize a matter transmitter that will go off by accident? And he said, oh, yes. He said, you tell me what makes it malfunction. It's much easier to figure out how it works. And he came back to me with a description of a matter transmitter that would fit the bill, fit the story. Obviously, it's something that we're nowhere near creating in the present day, but he made it sound plausible. So, again, it is still fitting together on this level, that there's some kind of a link between the Earth and this settlement on another planet. And probably, if you look at what it would take to establish a settlement of terrestrial life in a non-terrestrial biosphere, you'd need instantaneous links. You'd need to be able to bring in supplies and personnel and what,
right?
Just to make it work.
Sure. Well, so one of the things that I was noticing when I just was looking at the Wikipedia page about the children real quickly is it mentions several times that the girl seemed to be the wording is something like that she was of loose moral character. Basically, it made it sound like she got around. Why is that significant?
All right. There are two major reasons. One is there's no record of the children having been made royal wards. But if there was even an informal arrangement of that nature, where the king had said to Dekalna, right, you are responsible for this girl, he would have been obliged when she reached the apparent age of 14, since they didn't know what age she was. When she reached the age of 14, Dekalna would have been obliged to find her a husband and provide her with a dowry, which would have been a piece of his own land, unless she were unchaste.
Oh.
And Dekalna, who is now an old man and maybe getting a bit selfish, is making a point of saying at Coggeshall Abbey, where the story will get back to the king, oh, she's very loose, you know, she's wanton, she's lascivious, we can't do a thing with her.
Okay.
But there is another angle to it, which is even more extraordinary. Before she married Richard Barr, she had an illegitimate child in 1178. And Richard Barr made himself responsible for the child. Agnes seems to have rejected him, rejected the baby. Richard Barr took the child and arranged for the boy to be raised by his family's neighbours in Staffordshire. And he acquired land for which further north, which he arranged for the boy to take over when he came of age. And Richard Barr at that point suddenly got all kinds of promotion, from particularly from the king, but also from the church. If several people said to me, a couple of historians separately suggested to me when I told them about this, that the boy had actually been fathered by Henry II himself.
Possibly
against Agnes's will. And people said, well, maybe you should be looking at the rituals of Beltane, when it was still the old way that the Lord of the Forest would ritually deflower a virgin. And the king is the ultimate Lord of the Forest in this time. And I thought that was really fanciful. I thought, we're getting into the medieval bodice ripper historical novels here. But I thought, okay, let's check it out. So I went to Henry II, the itinerary of Henry II, which was written down in great detail from historical records by a clergyman named Ayton in the late 18th century. Lo and behold, at Beltane the previous year, Henry II was on Dekalna's Manor. He was at Wykes, north of Bury St. Edmunds, that's Dekalna's place. And suddenly you think, yeah, with his interest in the supernatural and the paranormal, it would have been entirely characteristic of Henry to say, let's just find out how human she is, without her consent. So, wow. Yeah, putting the two strands together, I think we can explain this wanton and lascivious bit on both counts.
Sure.
Okay. Well, I have a question from Frank in chat, and he wants to know if you know anything about the two green children found in Banjos, Spain in 1887, and is there a tie-in?
It's a hoax. It was written by a UFO writer called Wilkins, who got it from William of Newburgh's Chronicle and moved it bodily to Spain. And there are lots of internal clues in that Banjos narrative to tell you that's where it came from. There isn't actually any such place as Banjos. The Spanish incident is simply a hoax. H.T. Wilkins was into that. He attributed another UFO event in the north of England to William of Newburgh, but he put it in the wrong century. He seems to have been into that kind of thing.
Okay. And Chad suggested that perhaps these kids could be a time travel type of situation. Has there been any thought into that? Is that a possibility you've looked into?
Oh, well spotted. In the first draft of the book, I actually had a chapter and a half on time travel. And when I made the deal with Sean Martin of Mutus Liber to publish the book, he said, well, yeah, I really like it. We're going to do it, but you're going to have to make it a whole third shorter and simplify it somewhat because there are too many angles to this and it's too big. And I decided in consultation with him to take the time travel angle out. But there could be another book called Children from the Future. But that's something I'm actually going to discuss with him on Saturday. But in fact, it is an alternative possibility. One of the things that is striking about the whole story is that if it's all being staged by extraterrestrials, if it is some kind of X-Files scenario, where are the extraterrestrials themselves? They don't feature. All right. The characters in the story are human. The late Chris Boyce, particularly my great friend, the science and science fiction writer, he particularly favoured the time travel idea. He pushed me to consider it. And the last chapter, I did originally have a final chapter to the book called Time Travel After All. With a question mark, let's do the time warp again kind of thing.
Nice reference, I like that.
Yeah. I have been looking at other cases in history of children appearing in strange circumstances, and yeah, maybe. I wouldn't rule it out at this stage, okay. But I'm more attracted personally to the hypothesis I've got, but time travel is an alternative possibility. Yes.
So, are there similar cases to this then?
One or two. I don't want to reveal too much at this stage, but
sure.
Yes.
There are. That's interesting. So this is not necessarily as isolated as it sounds then.
Well, I've only found two other possible instances. But, of course, if it is time travel, and we're talking about alternative tracks in history, in my first draft of the book, the last sentence of the last chapter read, in that case, it's anyone's guess where those children will turn up next.
No.
But they haven't. Yeah. They haven't so far.
That's true. Well, and then Patty wanted to know if anybody had considered the possibility that the children were like subterranean beings as opposed to extraterrestrial.
Well, it's been thought about, but I don't think it fits the facts at any point.
Hollow Earth.
It doesn't go at all with the story the children told. They said it was twilight. They didn't say we lived underground or in a cave or anything like that. They lived under open sky.
Right.
But the sun didn't rise or set there, and there was permanent sunlight on the other side of the river. Right. But they weren't fazed by the sky when they got here. It was the sun that astonished them.
They
got this great painting by Sidney Jordan that's on the cover of the book.
It's a fascinating story, and of course you've written about it, and people can buy the book. What's the name of the book?
The book is called Children from the Sky. It's published by Mutus Liber in Edinburgh, and it's available on Amazon and any good bookshop. Yes, I would like people to go and buy it and work their way through it, check out all the research, and I've given all the references.
Great.
Yeah, I'd like there to be more.
Okay, cool. So I wanted to get that in before I switched gears, because I know that you have something else that you've done that I find absolutely fascinating, and that's that you supervised the building of an astronomically aligned stone circle. Correct?
Correct.
Tell us about that.
Essentially, in 1978, I was approached by my old friend, Professor Archie Roy of Glasgow University, who, sadly, the founder of the Scottish Society of Psychical Research, by the way, wearing his other hat. He's a professor of astronomy and world expert on astrodynamics, but he was very much into the paranormal. He and I were old friends. We'd met through what was then the Scottish branch of the British Interplanetary Society. And he contacted me because he had been asked if he would take this project on, and he wasn't interested. But he said, I told him I might know someone who was crazy enough. And the brief under the jobs creation scheme, which was a piece of political window dressing by the Labour government of the day to make it look as if they were doing something about unemployment. Essentially, a lot of money had been given to the Glasgow Parks Department, but they, to justify it, among other things, they had to have special projects, and one of these it had been decided should be an astronomy project. The original brief was to build a copy of a monument such as Stonehenge or Callanish in modern materials as an astronomical monument in one of the city's parks. And when I was offered the job, I had to make it clear to the Parks Department and the Manpower Services Commission that a copy of an ancient monument wouldn't work, because it would be on the wrong latitude. The tilt of the Earth's axis has altered by half a degree in the meantime. Precession of the equinoxes has changed the rising points and setting points of the stars. And altogether, what I would have to do was find a suitable site and design a monument according to the ancient principles, if that was what they wanted. And then I said, having got agreement to that, I said, let's go the whole mile and forget the modern materials. Let's build it in stone and make it a tribute to Professor Alexander Tom and his son, Dr. Archie Tom, to Dr. Roy himself, and to Dr. Ewan Mackay, four of the very top experts in British ancient astronomy, all of them previous or current members of Glasgow University staff, and closely connected with the city. And that too was agreed to. So now I had the go-ahead to go and do it, to build the first astronomically aligned stone circle in the British Isles for at least 3,000 years, which we did.
It's very cool. I'm looking, actually. It's the Site Hill Stone Circle, correct?
Correct.
SiteHillStoneCircle.net. And I see that there's a Save Our Stone. So is it in danger of falling apart or decaying, or what needs saving?
It's worse than that. Finally, after all these years, what happened was the project was in the last... As it was nearing completion, The project was denounced in the House of Commons. Margaret Thatcher's government had just taken office, and it was declared that she would be restoring full employment and there will be no more nonsense like the Glasgow... The Jobs Creation Scheme will be terminated. There will be no more nonsense like the Glasgow Parks Astronomy Project. So I wasn't allowed to complete it.
Oh, that's too bad.
It has lain unused, all these years. And finally, a couple of years ago now, I managed to place the book telling the story of the circle and of the observations I've made at it over the intervening years. And it was published by Springer in November of last year. And in the same week, in fact, before I knew the book had actually come out, my wife and I were summoned to a meeting at Development and Regeneration Services, because we'd heard that the Sighthill area was going to be developed and we wanted to know what would happen to the circle, how it could be made a part of that. And the chap that we spoke to said, oh, there's nothing to discuss. It's coming down. That's all there is to it.
We have
to show that Glasgow is serious about bidding for the 2018 Youth Olympics. And one of the things we're going to do to show that we're serious is destroy the park, stone circle and all. And in order to have vacant ground for the Olympic Village. And I was, needless to say, I was completely shocked. We had been putting together an event for the winter solstice at the circle, and the invitations went out saying, come and see it, this may be your last chance. And by the end of the day, a petition had sprung up. Thousands of people have now signed it.
Good.
And one of the major things that has come out of it is that, in fact, people have been making use of the circle for their own ends. In particular, Druid groups and pagan groups have been making use of it for years, and not making a big deal of it, but lots of people, both as individuals and as groups, have been making use of the circle, which the chap we were speaking to at DRS said, oh, nobody knows about it, nobody cares about it, nobody goes there. And I couldn't disprove it at the time, but I can now, because so many people in signing the petition have given their reasons. So we can now demonstrate that the circle means a great deal to a great many people.
Sure.
And not because of its scientific and historical significance, but many of them for personal or even religious reasons, or spiritual reasons, as the case may be. So the campaign is continuing. I have had an apology for the way my wife and I were treated, which was very abrupt, very rude and related.
Yes,
sure.
I won't go into details, but it wasn't a pleasant interview. I've had an apology for that, and I've been told that I will be kept in the loop regarding what has happened. But the Olympics proposal has gone to the next stage. The city has now been shortlisted for the 2018 Youth Olympics, and the decision will be taken within the next couple of months on which of the four remaining cities in contention will actually get it. And at this point, the council officials are still saying, well, the park's got to go. My campaign has now shifted into, can we preserve the circle if the park around it is going to go? Can we make it part of the Olympic site and the subsequent development? And that's the angle I'm now pursuing. Everybody, yes, come and sign the petition, www.sighthillstonecircle.net. Save our stones is the first thing you'll see when the home page opens. And go to the petition and sign it. We need all the help we can get here.
So I'm curious, in the building of this, how do you go about determining the alignments?
Well, having studied positional astronomy under Archie Roy, I knew where to start. In fact, because of his own involvement in the field, he had actually set the first year class the exercise of constructing on paper such a site. It was one of the most interesting tutorials I ever took part in, full of great lines like "Pass me the chisel, I want to mark the position of Jupiter and Norton Star Atlas," things like that. I had actually done it in my head before. What essentially I did was to work out for the the solar and lunar events, what the basic alignments would be for the city, the theoretical alignments. And they gave me an official car and a big magnetic compass called a Meynard's dial. And I went round 18 sites that I was told could be open for consideration. And just seeing how the alignments, the rough alignments checked with the skyline. And when I went up onto the summit of the Broom Hill, which is the actual name of the hill, which was was in the process of being turned into what is now Sighthill Park, as soon as I went up onto the hilltop, I just thought, this is the place. Yeah, it was a perfect natural skyline all the way around. I thought, yeah, this is going to be it. The late John Braithwaite then joined me on the project, and he and I did an initial rough survey, finding out which spot on the hilltop would be best, and it turned out to be the actual high point, which the Parks consultants at that time were preserving for a viewpoint. So they were very pleased when we came to them with a proposal. Then, from there on, it was a mixture of calculations and graphical work. We were then joined by Gavin Roberts, who's now a principal teacher of art in his later years. He took initially a panorama from the chosen site right round 360 degrees, and then photographs along each of the sidelines, which we blew up into very large prints. And working with the Parks Department survey team, we did a theodolite survey, plotting where the theoretical rising and setting points of the sun and moon at the solstices and the standstills would be. And then graphically, I worked out where on the horizon the event would actually appear to occur. And after 30 years of observation, I can say that some of them I got exactly right. And the more interesting ones I didn't. The events are still in line with the stones, but there is an overall bias to the right of where I said the events would happen. And that is because atmospheric refraction in the denser than normal air over the city makes things rising appear to the right. The track is lower than it actually is. And so they rise to the right of prediction. And they also, and for the opposite reason, they set to the right of prediction, because the track is higher than predicted. So the interesting thing is, because it's not perfect, we have learned something very important. At that time, the position of the archaeological world, which has only really changed in the last 2-3 years, was that there was no organization in Neolithic society to a level that would allow this kind of precision work to be done. And anyway, you couldn't determine the astronomical alignments with the kind of precision Professor Tom was talking about by naked observation. Well, you can now prove from my site that you could have done it to that degree of precision.
Wow,
very interesting.
So, if I got it perfect, we wouldn't have learned that. But
right.
And you can't prove it at the ancient sites, because, as I say, there's a 40,000 year shift in the Earth's axis between 22 degrees and 24 degrees, and it has declined by half a degree since the Neolithic time. So things don't rise and set exactly where they used to. And that enabled the archaeologists to say, well, there's nothing to it. It's all just balderdash coincidence. Well, it isn't. I can now show you at my circle that if we'd done it with naked eye observation over a generation or two, we could have got it much more accurate than it is.
Wow. That's fascinating. Well, so it's an interesting site, and I urge people to go. It's called sighthillstonecircle.net is the website. And there's some great pictures of it, some great pictures of you. And I see that there's some other things. You've written a few articles on the site and things like that as well. So it's fascinating to me. And stone circles, do fascinate me. Here in Washington State, we have a replica of Stonehenge down in kind of south central Washington that we take the kids to because it's kind of fun to go see. And so stone circles really fascinate me, and it's really cool that you did this.
Well, I'm proud of it. And also, there was an awful lot of goodwill involved. The quarry let us out. In fact, quarries all over the west of Scotland helped us as best they could, but the quarry that stones came from really pulled out the stones, and they actually supplied the stones for virtually nothing. And the Royal Navy provided a helicopter to complete the circle after we'd put the big lunar stones in, mm-hmm. and they gave all the local schools the day off, and thousands of cheering children surrounded the site as it was done.
Oh, what a great experience to have, though.
It's wonderful, yeah. And it's an awful shame if it gets knocked down now. Yeah. I really hope that we can save it.
So I have to ask, just because you know there are a lot of theories that I think have been fairly thoroughly disproven surrounding stone circles. That you know there's alien involvement. That ancient people couldn't have done this. They could have, correct? I mean, from your experience, oh, yes.
Oh, yes. Yes, I don't think there's any doubt about who built it and you know, what went on over a period of at least 2,000 to 3,000 years. There is one wild card in the pack, however. There's a joker in there, which Springer allowed me to mention in passing. I think they had thoughts about asking me to take it out of the book, but they let me leave it in because it's only a throwaway mention. But I did do some very interesting work before the Circle Project. In fact, this was partly why Archie Roy asked me if I would be willing to take it on. I was working with a chap who at that time was in British military intelligence by the name of Alan Evans, who was interested on a personal level in the idea of past contact with extraterrestrials. And Alan has a most extraordinary grasp of spatial relationships. He'd approached me to see if I could check out some hunches he had about some very curious alignments within Stonehenge. And you must remember that Stonehenge was at the end of the Neolithic period. It was the last of the great circles to be built.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're not talking about extraterrestrials being involved in the whole process, but there are some very curious things about Stonehenge 3. Well, Stonehenge 1, and not more so, rather, really, than Stonehenge 3, but Stonehenge 1 you need to focus on. It appears to have galactic alignments, which you could only do with a radio telescope or a spaceship.
Oh.
And there's an ecliptic relationship also built into Stonehenge, which ties in with the pyramids. And it's absolutely extraordinary when you see it. It's definitely true. You can verify this stuff in a planetarium. The ecliptic meridian through Stonehenge meets the prime meridian running through the first and last of the Great Pyramids at the equator.
Really?
Quite extraordinary. But true, it is so hard to believe. I've verified it, not just mathematically, but over and over again in planetaria. Right. And it is a fact. And the same galactic alignments are found in the Step Pyramid and the Great Pyramid that are built into Stonehenge, the same two.
That seems like a mighty big coincidence, doesn't it?
Yes, but you don't need mass extraterrestrial contact to explain it. One ship will do it.
Right.
But okay, well, here we go. Nobody's ever quite got this far in an interview before, but here we go. I wrote this up also for Analog.
Uh-huh.
I got the proofs back for the article, and they said we're very short of time. Can you return the proofs as soon as you may? And at that time, I was living in Glasgow, but I was still going to the family dentist that I grew up with in Prestwick down the coast. And I actually marked up the proofs on the train going down to Prestwick because I had a dental appointment. I posted them to the USA in Prestwick. And I went and got my tooth filled. And then I went for a walk on the beach. And I was walking along Prestwick Beach, thinking over the article. And one of the things that I had said at the end of the article is there any connection with the Green Children article that I had last year? And the only thing I could see was that the sun was very disturbed at both periods. And then I thought, wait a minute, if there is anything to it, there ought to be galactic alignments at one of the Green Children sites. So I called Alan Evans, and he said, send me the coordinates, I'll look into it. And he called me back 24 hours later, and he said, I've found it. Medieval Jerusalem has the same galactic alignments that you find in the pyramids in Stonehenge. And the period in which the galactic equator and the galactic pole were lined up and the galactic centre were lined up in that way in the sky over Jerusalem runs from 1146, which is the Second Crusade, to 1187, when the city fell to Saladin. And I've got circumstantial evidence that puts Richard de Calne in the city on both dates.
Oh my gosh. So what's it all mean?
It means that the two inquiries, and the third one, which we haven't even mentioned, which is the radio one involving long-delayed radio echoes and Epsom Botis, it means that the three inquiries are the same inquiry. One into Neolithic alignments just at those two sites, Stonehenge and the pyramids, and one into mysterious radio signals picked up in the 1920s, and one into this very strange story of the lost children in medieval times, and they're all the same inquiry. They all link up. So I'm onto something.
Wow, that's actually a little bit mind-blowing. I'm going to have to think about that for a while.
It's in the book.
So it's in, which book is it in?
It's in Children from the Sky.
It's in Children from the Sky. Well, I will be picking that up. It's on Kindle, right?
I don't know if there is a Kindle version of it. There's a Kindle version of, or at least an e-book version of the Stones and the Stars, the Stone Circle book. But as far as I know, there isn't an electronic version of Children from the Sky.
Okay. I can read real books too.
It's a nice book. It's illustrated by Sidney Jordan, who is a character not nearly as well known in the United States as he is in Europe. He drew Jeff Hawke, which was the world's longest running science fiction comic strip. It ran in British newspapers and around the world from 1954 to 1988. And towards the end, I was writing stories for it. They're now all being reprinted by the Jeff Hawke Club, and it's my privilege to be writing the notes on it, which is a labour of love. But I persuaded Sidney Jordan to illustrate Children from the Sky, and it's despite his very long career as a graphics artist, that was the first book he'd ever illustrated. And it's worth it for the pictures alone.
Yeah, it's definitely always, if you can't read, at least look at the pictures. So, you know, Duncan, it's been an amazing evening. Just speaking about these kind of things, Karen said, it's incredibly mind-blowing to even...
My mind is blown, officially.
My mind is blown, yeah. Officially. It's a hard thing to do.
Great questions. You've got right to the heart of it. What I sometimes find with interviews is that people just want to talk about Epsilon Boetus, which was the famous thing in its day, and it's quite difficult to get them onto the Green Children at all. You've gone for the stuff I'm currently doing, and I appreciate that. Great questions.
Well, I'm excited to read the book. And do you have a website other than the Sight Hill Stone Circle? Do you have a personal website?
Not yet. My wife and I were running several different websites for our different projects, including one dedicated to Children from the Sky. But it's proved to be too much work. What we're in the process of doing is centralizing operations on the Stone Circle website, because the campaign to save the Stone Circle is the major thing right now. And we're going to turn that into my personal site once the battle has been hopefully won.
Oh, fingers crossed. I hope it works out for you.
But once that phase is over, what we're going to do is make that into my personal website with these different stories on it.
Great. But
that's to come. For the moment, the Side Hill site is the only one we've got.
Okay, well, okay. Very good. So the book is Children from the Sky. The website is Site Hill Stone Circle. And anything else that you would like our readers to know about before we let you get some sleep, since it's like, what, about 4-something in the morning there now?
Yeah, well, no, it's only 3:47.
Oh, okay.
Oh, no. But yeah, the Stone Circle book is called The Stones and the Stars, and you'll find them together on Amazon or pretty well anywhere else.
Okay.
Although they're by different publishers, people seem to be selling both. And I might just modest cough mention that I've actually had 3 books published last year. The one that's on Kindle is called With Time Comes Concord and Other Stories, and it's a collection of my time travel stories, edited by Gary Gibson, who is a chap who started off in the Glasgow Science Fiction Writer Circle, which I founded many years ago now, and is now a big name writer in his own right. And so he's done that. And
fantastic.
All 3 of those in the last year. It was a busy year.
It was. So here's what I hope that you will be willing to do. After I read the book, I'd like to talk to you again. And we can do it where we do a pre-record so you don't have to stay up until, you know, the wee hours of the morning. So we can record the show after I've read the book and have another conversation, if that would be okay with you.
Absolutely fine.
Very good. Okay, so everybody, it's Duncan Lunan, and the books are Children from the Sky, The Stones and the Stars, and With Time Comes Concord. You can find them all on Amazon.com, and the website is, of course, SightHillStoneCircle.net. Sign the petition and save the circle, because it sounds like it's really worthwhile. Duncan, thank you for staying up late to talk to us. I hope you get some sleep.
Thank you, Duncan.
Thank you very much indeed.
Good night.
Good night.
Oh, gosh, Rick, my mind is officially blown. I'm going to read that book. You know, this is what happens as we interview people on the show, and then my reading list just grows by leaps and bounds.
Yeah.
You won't find Children from the Sky a light read, I've got to say. It's got an awful lot of history in it, and I have not... Being a medieval historian, I thought, I really have got to make absolutely certain I get this right. I took, 18 and a half years on it altogether.
Oh, my goodness. It's your life's, wow. It's part of your life's work anyway. So, well, yeah, it's, I don't mind. I like books that aren't, I read books on quantum physics and stuff. So, you know, I'm okay with not light reads. I'm fine with that.
And I like history, so.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Looking forward to reading it. So, Cheryl, what do we have coming up on the show next week?
Hi, I just want to say good job. I really enjoyed that interview. Thank you, Duncan. I can't believe it's, what is it, 4 now?
Yeah, Duncan, if you want to go to bed, you don't have to stick to the end of the show. We're just doing some wrap-up stuff.
Yeah, no, yeah. That was great. We're buying the books here soon. Yep. So, Chad and I are going to read them and get some questions together, and hopefully Duncan can join us again soon.
I hope so.
Thank you so much. Next week on the show, we have 2 guests. We have Andrew, why do I always get tripped up with his name? Basiago, and he is the president of Project Pegasus. Now, Andrew is going to be an interesting guest.
It's the Project Pegasus show?
Yes, because he's going to be talking about time travel, of which he says he has firsthand experience. He's going to be talking about life on Mars and the U.S.'s secret presence on Mars, and how they use time travel to establish that secret presence. So I don't even know.
Sounds like a little bit of conspiracy theory involved.
And he's from Washington State, by the way.
Oh, is he? Okay.
Yes, I noticed he's down just a little south of me. So
interesting. Maybe,
yeah. So, and who's our second guest?
Our second guest is Dina Ray. She is a paranormal fiction writer. She wrote Halo of the Damned and Bad Juju, but she also has a little bit of an interest in conspiracy theories. So we're going to be talking to her also about some of her favorite conspiracy theories, as well as talking about her books.
Okay, very good. And coming up after us tonight is Fox City's Paranormal, and they're going to be talking to Thomas Fusco, right?
Yes.
Yep. Yeah, and right, he's after been us on our show before. He's fascinating. Yeah. He's a big science guy, and he has some really interesting theories about paranormal activity. Let's see what else. Check out my new book, Dancing with the Afterlife. You can find it at dancingwiththeafterlife.com or on my personal website, KarenFrazier.com. Look forward to Rick's book coming out here very soon.
Yes.
And it's called The Geek's Guide to...
The Paranormal, Poltergeist, Ghosts, and Demons.
There you go. And there's an issue of Paranormal Underground. It's out. It's got Ben Hansen on the cover. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, that's our February issue. Ben Hansen's on the cover. He's from Sci-Fi's Fact or Fake Paranormal Files. We have a lot of good articles in there. And actually, our March issue is going to be online next Friday or Saturday. On the cover of that issue is actually that we're gonna have two people featured on the cover, Amy Allen and Steve DeShavi from the Dead Files, which is the Travel Channel show that usually follows ghost adventures. And we've talked to Steve and Amy a couple of times on the show, and March 7th we are going to be airing a pre-recorded interview with them. Which is our second interview with him on the radio show, and they talk a lot about some of the cases that are coming up and some of the past cases. It's a really good interview. Great. So we're excited about that.
Yeah. Hey, is there going to be an excerpt of my new book in March?
There is. Thank you for letting us run that. You can get a look at Karen's book. It's going to be how long? I don't know. Probably about what?
It's not terribly long. Pages? It's, you know, about 1,000 words maybe. So it's not real long.
Not too long. So, but anyway, it'll give people a good idea of the tone of the book, and so they can check that out.
The tone. I took a tune. Yeah. So that'll be. Yeah. It should be a good issue. And then also, I want to put in a plug here because I know that I got you. From my good friend Patty, the email of Kristen from Ghost Mine.
Yeah.
And I want you to know that I had a really bad day one day this week, and so I hadn't watched Ghost Mine, but everybody was saying, hey, this is a pretty good show.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen it.
And so I curled up on the couch with my dog and watched every episode of Ghost Mine. Get her on the show because I have some questions for her.
Yeah, definitely. That was nice of Patty to forward us her contact info. In fact, I plan on contacting her next week.
That's right. And if you like, what did I say? Oh, Deadliest Catch.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like it was a combination of like Deadliest Catch or a show like that and a paranormal show.
I'm going to have to watch it because I'll be honest, I really didn't. I've seen about 10 minutes and then I had to leave. So I didn't even get a chance to finish it.
They had their season finale last night. So there's only about 6 shows. I mean, it was a pretty quick run. But it's a mine here in Oregon, here in Oregon. I feel like I live in Oregon because I'm just north of it. But it's a mine in Oregon, and it's a great show. Watch it. It's a lot of fun. And, you know, stick with it if the first show kind of, whatever. Just stick with it. It's kind of interesting.
Okay.
Okay, so do we have anything else? So pick up Duncan's books. They're available on Amazon.com. You know, because here's the deal. I'm going to be reading Children from the Sky, and hopefully Rick is too, and then we're going to get Duncan back on and ask some questions, so you should read it to listeners so that you're right there with us.
Yeah, definitely.
Definitely.
Hey, and also just I don't know if I gave up the website. I'm going to give it out again just in case. People can find the magazine on paranormalunderground.net, and they can go there, download a PDF copy for $1.99, or they can actually go to MagCloud, search for Paranormal Underground magazine, and they can buy a print copy from MagCloud.
Yep. Oh, and also check out OregonGhostConference.com for the location and speakers at the conference that several Paranormal Underground folks are going to be appearing at here in early March.
Cool.
Have we? Did we get everything? Did we promote absolutely everything we possibly could?
Yes.
Buy my book.
Yeah.
Buy mine.
Buy everybody's book.
Look, if Rick's come that Rick comes out, buy his too.
Yeah.
And the magazine.
Yep.
And the radio show.
Wait, no, the radio. Can't buy the radio show.
All right, everybody. So stick around for Fox City's Paranormal with Thomas Fusco. We loved having him on the show. He was a lot of fun. So I'm sure they're going to have a great show tonight. Otherwise, we'll be back next week. We're going to be talking about Project Pegasus. I'm so excited. Time travel.
Woo.
I know. I'm ready to have my mind blown again.
Yeah.
You know what's going to happen is I'll just get it finally knitted together after tonight's conversation and then...
You'd be blown again. Blown away again, I mean.
I know. All right. So anyway, stick around. And otherwise, we'll talk to you next week, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. Other times in the flyover states here at Paranormal Underground Radio on Z-Talk Radio. You guys have a great Thursday evening and have a great weekend. Good night.
You too. Bye-bye.
Good night.
If you'd like to be a guest on Paranormal Underground Radio, email editor@paranormalunderground.net. Until next week, keep exploring the unexplained at www.paranormalunderground.net and join us again next week for Paranormal Underground Radio on the Z-Talk Radio Network.